Hello and welcome to The Sound of Economics from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic policy think tank. I am Maria de Mergis, I am the deputy director at Bruegel. And today my host is the director of Bruegel, Guntram Wolf, and we're talking about the strategic agenda for the new EU leadership. Welcome, Guntram, and thank you for coming.
Thank you, Maria.
Guntram, explain to our audience what's going on in Brussels. We just had elections in Europe. We've got a very interesting outcome. If you could talk us through that, and then we can move on slowly after that into terms of what happens in the next 5 years.
Well, thank you, Maria. There is now a big discussion in Europe about the so-called strategic agenda in Europe. So everybody has been focusing very much at the beginning on names, on people who will be in what position. And then they all realize, well, it's actually very difficult to find a good set of people where all constraints are fulfilled. So let's first talk about substance. What should be the program for the new leadership for the next 5 years? So what should be the substance of what Europe should be working on? And there is actually two parallel processes that are ongoing. One is the process in the Council. The Council meets regularly now at the CORREPER level, even at the heads of state level, and they discuss what should be the strategic agenda, what should be the priorities for the European Union. And at the same time, the European Parliament has said, well, wait a minute, we are in charge. We have actually received an endorsement by Europe's voters. Our election turnout has increased significantly. So let's let the European Parliament decide the strategic agenda. And the European Parliament has set up actually 5 working groups which define the key topics that the Parliament wants to see progress on. And that has been committees set up especially by the 4 big parties, so the centre-right, centre-left, Greens and the Liberals. And the 5 topics are basically: one topic is environment, sustainability and biodiversity. Second topic is economic and social policy, industrial policy, taxation and EMU reform. The third topic is innovation, digitalization, AI and the single market. The fourth is the rule of law and fight against terrorism, border and migration. And the last one is Europe in the world. So these are the 5 topics that the Parliament discusses. And they want to, in these committees, set out what exactly they think Europe should be doing. Now, in parallel, the Council is having a discussion on what they think should be the strategic agenda. And, you know, they talk about 4 topics: protecting citizens and freedoms, developing a modern, strong and vibrant economic base, building a more climate-friendly, green, fair and inclusive future, and finally, defending Europe's interests and values in the global stage. So you see, there is, of course, quite some overlap between those two agendas. But in the end, I think what matters here is that both sides claim leadership on defining what are the priorities. And both sides will, in the nitty-gritty details, in the details of what they put in these strategic agenda, actually differ quite a lot. And whoever comes into the new positions will actually be quite constrained by the various compromises that will have to be struck along those topical areas of the strategic agenda.
But if I may stop here for a minute before we go into the substance, and I'm sure we're going to have a good discussion on the substance, explain a little bit for the benefit of our audience, why is there a need for 2 parallel processes? And as you also said, there is a huge overlap between the two. But what is it? Why isn't really just the one agenda that is being endorsed by those who govern in Brussels and in the capitals? And why is there a need to sort of having 2 parallel ones?
You can argue perhaps there isn't a need, but what is happening is that there is an inter-institutional fight. So the Council, on the one hand, wants to set very clearly an agenda and wants to re-establish the principle that the European Council, so the heads of state and government, they are really in charge of setting the broad guidelines, the broad strategic agenda. And they, by the way, are also the ones that should select the Commission president that then gets voted and elected also in the Parliament. But the European Council has the right of initiative. And at the same time, the Parliament, since the last election, has increased its claim on setting the agenda and, you know, wants to show leadership. But, you know, I think in the end, it's perhaps not an unhealthy process to have sort of 2 sources of legitimacy, two sources of legitimacy for the future European agenda. One, which is coming out of the direct election of European parliamentarians representing citizens. And on the other hand, the countries and the governments of the various member states. In the end, the agenda, especially at the beginning, will be driven by those two. But I think the more a commission president establishes himself or herself, the more he or she will actually start driving the agenda herself or himself.
So, I mean, that's on the governance side of the way the decision will be made here in Brussels. So let's go a little bit on the context now, because apart from the two parallel processes, also we here at Bruegel have been thinking about those priorities. And I wanted to start the discussion on the content as you described it. As you also showed, there is a very huge overlap between the two. And do you share the topics? Do you think there is something missing? And what would be your the way that you would order them?
Well, we are publishing our joint paper this week together with André Sapir, in which we set out our strategic agenda. So yet another document that the political leadership should consider, in our view at least. And what I found quite striking is that the various discussions we've had I think did sort of leave an imprint also on the overall European debate, the Brussels debate, and there's actually quite some overlap in the topics that I think we are mentioning. Our paper comes out with three central themes. So we have a sort of Descartesian mind and wanted to restrict ourselves to three topics, not four or five, because four or five is always a strange number and difficult to retain. So three big priorities. The first one is Europe in the world. What's the place of Europe in a world where you see a geostrategic rivalry between China and the United States? So that's the first big topic. The second big topic we emphasize is climate and biodiversity. And the third big topic is basically economic growth, convergence, and cohesion in Europe. So these are our three main topics. Obviously, migration and the rule of law and all of this also plays into our memo, and we have that in the document, but it's not one of the three top-line topics.
So I suppose this is the way that we put the priorities in the discussion and the way that we will structure that. We would like to see the discussions being structured both at the European Parliament and at the Council. Well, let's start with the first one. The first one is Europe in the global world, strategic rivalries between the US on one hand and China on the other, escalation of trade wars that are probably going to hit Europe as well at some point. We already priced them in our forecast in terms of how the economy will do. What do you think is Europe's position there? What do you think, strategically speaking, Europe should do in order to ensure that it has got a good place in that game?
Well, I think there's a number of points to be made. The first point is that the European Union, when it comes to trade policy, is relatively strongly positioned. I mean, we have a strong European trade policy and can leverage access to our market very, very strongly, and so are a recognized voice at the WTO. But unfortunately, these conflicts are not just about trade. I mean, they are intermingling trade with power, with geostrategic positioning, with leverage and leadership in technology. And in these fields, the European Union is much less strong than the respective partners, because we traditionally have a separation between sort of the internal market dimension and the single market dimension and the trade dimension on the one hand, and on the other hand, security dimension, which is much more at the national level. And so one of the challenges I think for the new leadership will be to reflect very much on sort of extreme scenarios. What happens if this deteriorates much, much more and it becomes an outright geostrategic confrontation where the United States and China will each try to lure us into their camp and say, well, either you are with us or we stop doing anything with you. We might even retreat and retract our security protection that we are currently offering to you, as the US president seems to be suggesting. So this becomes really a very complicated game. And I think in the end, the European Union needs to beef up its own capacity on the security side, but it also to defend Europe if necessary. But it also needs to think very carefully about strategic networks, how to leverage strategic networks and, you know, become a real player in these networks and not just a consumer depending on US and Chinese provisioning of technology and networks.
It's a very interesting dimension, something that we haven't seen in a long time, that, you know, our ability to define our economic decisions in whichever way we think is optimal, to be constrained by our limitations on the security side. That dimension is something we haven't seen in a long time. It's reminiscent of rather older times, but it's one that, if I hear you correctly, is actually very relevant now. And, you know, we need to think about the two of them in parallel and in conjunction with each other. So what do you think the one thing that Europe needs to do on this level? What would be the one policy recommendation that the new leadership should think about?
Well, I think there's many. On the trade side, my clear point is support multilateralism and be ready to retaliate against aggression. On the security side and technology side, beef up our own technology, beef up our industrial policy, become more independent from, reduce your dependence on key technology and networks, but also beef up your own security.
If we go to the second theme, the issue of climate, the demand for adjustment in terms of the climate change is now exorbitant. And I mean, particularly from the young, you see it, that they basically there's no time to waste. Do you think we're doing enough on this front? Europe has always exercised leadership on the issue, but is there a long way to go still?
I think there's a long way to go. And I have a lot of sympathy with the young people, I have to say. The key point here is that increasingly, and we reference the scientific evidence, increasingly there's evidence that climate change is happening faster than predicted, that temperatures are increasing more quickly than initially predicted, and that even the Paris goals might be not sufficient if we want to contain temperature rises, because there's self-reinforcing feedback loops. And related to that is a loss in biodiversity in Europe, around the world. Biodiversity is fundamental for our society, our livings, our natural resources. I mean, they all depend on biodiversity. If we lose that, we lose the future. And so the young people, I think, have a point in saying we need to speed up, but we need to do it right.
And what would it take to do that? I mean, some of the results that we're seeing and they're very prominent in our paper, this idea that even though we have managed to reduce the production of poisonous gases, we haven't actually managed to stop consuming them quite at the same rate. So if there is one message, and here is my question, isn't that our consumption levels, our consumption, in how it affects the climate, needs to adjust drastically, and without real and big adjustments effectively in our lifestyle, we are not going to see any visible progress in that front. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think I would agree with this. I mean, we are really talking here of a transformation that is very fundamental, that affects all parts of our economy, all parts of our daily lives. We can support that transformation with innovation, with industrial policy. It is also an economic opportunity, but it's going to be quite transformative. And I think to take up your point on the imports and exports, I think there is clearly also an international dimension to it, and we will probably have to do something in terms of carbon border adjustment to make sure that we don't just shift the production of emission-rich products to outside of Europe.
This is a very clear message, and I really hope that we are able to pass this message through in Brussels and beyond. Can I move quickly to the last point in our paper, which is, of course, the economy. It's not by any means the least important point. We know that citizens care about economic outcomes. They care about job security, employment, and the issue of cohesion. One of the elements that we've seen, perhaps as a legacy of the crisis, is a reduction in convergence and divergence, if I may say so, On the economic side, where do you see satisfying the demands that are coming from citizens? How would Europe need to organize itself to achieve good economic outcomes?
Well, there's many points one can talk about, and I want to also bring you in and let you talk a little bit about some of those points. I think one point that I would certainly emphasize is the issue of fair taxation. I think that's very much seen by citizens as currently being unfair, and we see that the marginal tax rates, so the top tax rates for rich individuals as well as for companies, have been falling quite significantly. So I think there is some readjustment needed there. But then there's issues around capital markets, banking union, the Eurozone, the international role of the euro, and all of this is, of course, absolutely crucial. And I mean, we've both been writing about it. So why don't you talk a little bit about what we think on that front?
Yeah, indeed. I mean, on the architectural side, it's really quite impressive how fast Europe managed to, and by Europe I really mean the EMU architecture here, has managed to react during the crisis. I mean, if you judge the speed at which new institutions were created, that's really quite impressive, certainly, for the track record of the EU. However, what you've seen now is that we do have a reform fatigue, and you know, we are incapable of just, you know, crossing that last mile. And I think that is a pity, because it really jeopardizes the ability of the system to sustain itself should new shocks, and, you know, from what we've heard in the conversation up to now, there have been the possibility of big things happening in the world is there, is very real, and it would be important for us to be prepared for it. I think the other thing which links and it transcends all the issues is this issue of innovation. How do we invest in the future? I think you can talk about creating new jobs, but how do you do that if you don't have the right fundamentals for it? And here you're talking about, you know, good education, innovation, research, investment that finds productive sources. I think that is crucial. And there are channels that we need to work on here in Europe. Some of them are architectural channels. Others have to do simply with the ability of getting on with it. I mean, investments are, in my view, a very big thing in that respect. And then the last thing I want to say, and here perhaps I can come back to you, Guntram, is this issue of cohesion. I mean, how do you see the lack of cohesion preventing us from maintaining a united front? Because I think that's an issue that, you know, given the challenges in the way you describe them in your first point, can we really meet those challenges unless we are really united?
Well, I think you make a very good point here. I mean, the issue of cohesion, the issue of trust, the issue of convergence. I think if you look at the performance of Europe, you see, of course, we have two countries that have been doing very badly in the last 10, 20 years, and that's basically Greece and Italy. And the Italian situation is also politically, then it's also reflected, the economic situation is also reflected in the political situation, where you see quite some divergence between Italy and the core of the Eurozone at this stage. And so I think one big question is sort of going forward, what can be done to sort of improve the outcomes for citizens in those two countries? And one dimension, obviously, is, and you've been writing a lot about this, is good institutions. I think this is absolutely fundamental. But there's, of course, also the system dimension, which is the Eurozone, right? I mean, how does the Eurozone operate? And certainly, while the spreads, as we see them currently, are welcome as a way of making sure that the market signals political risk and makes it more difficult to borrow, at the same time, it is a problem for the economy, and it undermines growth, and arguably is now at a point where it's actually becoming quite dangerous, in the sense that the interest rate is now higher than the growth rate in Italy, and that's very bad for debt dynamics and ultimately for the long-term sustainability of these debt levels. So a lot to be done. And let me perhaps ask you, Maria, on sort of the political cohesion point. I mean, Sibiu, the conference in Sibiu of the heads of state, has very much emphasized unity. So we all need to work together on all issues, and we need to unify ourselves, and as we have done in Brexit, and only then we are a player. Do you see that as the right proposition, and what are the limits?
I certainly see that as the right proposition. I think the need to repeat this is, however, extremely important, and is indicative of the fact that maybe we are regressing. And this is something that we're in the Europe of 21st century. We shouldn't really afford that. For me, the most important thing is really the rule of law, because without the rule of law, and you talked about institutions, but let me pick up on the rule of law in particular, because if we are regressing on the rule of law, there is nothing we can do to either sustain good economic outcomes and let alone maintain a united front when it comes to outside challenges. So I think that it would be, even if it's not one of the three priorities that we set out, I think it would be the sine qua non. You cannot do without the rule of law. And I think the new leadership needs to be a particular attention that we are not regressing on something that is so fundamental in at the core of the structures of our societies and effectively of our civilizations. So I think that would be my main message. It's important to move forward, sustain the values that Europe has put forward, ensure that we all agree on the very, very fundamental parts of that. And after that, maintain a united front on the challenges that we're going to meet. So with that, Guntram, I think we are coming to an end to this. There is no doubt that the next 5 years will be extremely important, not only for the discussions here in Brussels, but also for the issues, for the capitals, for the countries themselves in Europe. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Sound of Economics, in which we discussed the first memo of a series of memos that will be released this September, addressed to the new leadership here in Brussels.